So please welcome Danny Dorn.
Thank you very much for coming. The good news or bad news for you is that I decided not to put up any slides because I could just drown you with numbers and graphs and so on. But I suspect a lot of you know the basic statistics about inequality in Europe, and I'll describe them to you. And at the moment, the evidence is probably not the most interesting thing. At the moment, the most interesting thing is how on earth have we got to where we are? And that we can certainly talk about. And then what might happen next? And there we're entirely into speculation. I've divided this talk. I'm only going to talk about half an hour. So we're going to have half an hour for questions, by the way. I've divided the three parts. The landscape, the battle, and the war. The landscape is my take on the history of how we got to where we are. The middle part of the talk, the battle, is going to be all about the actual Brexit referendum and what happened there. And the war is where we currently are. I think it's a war about equality and inequality. I can be very biased. I've written quite a lot of books about inequality and equality. I probably think that these things are more important than they are. There'll be other things that matter more that get squeezed out of my mind. The landscape. We could go back a long way with the landscape. We could go back as far as when we lost our colony in America. There is some irony in that we might be coming back again, but in the sense to become a colony of America. But I'll leave that towards the end. I want to start with the Suez Crisis. Geographical. And the period from the Suez Crisis to the Panama Papers. One canal to another canal. And geography really matters. The Suez Crisis was before I was born. The Suez Crisis was when Britain, because America wouldn't support it, discovered that it wasn't as important as it thought it was. And it was seen as a terrible, terrible national tragedy that we couldn't cope with some tin pot dictators in Egypt, and we would have to move west of Suez and our influence wouldn't be great. And you need to think back to that time, I think, to think why we joined the European community. And it was partly realising, or beginning to realise, that we had become smaller, that we couldn't be great on our own. The other thing that was happening back then in the 1950s was that we were becoming dramatically more economically equal. And a lot of these things were not realised at the time, or not seen as particularly important at the time. All countries in Europe in the 1920s and 1930s were very unequal places. The best off 1% had about 20% of all income. They did things like collect together money so they could start colleges like this one. That kind of period of people having so much wealth that if they fancied starting a college they could just do it has kind of gone. It went down. We became so equal in the 1970s that Oxford University had to build buildings out of very cheap concrete. It wasn't actually nice style architecture, it just ran out of money. As inequality has risen again, you'll notice buildings built out of a very expensive stone again, and the occasional very rich person building something just up there, but they're from Russia. Why were we the second country to think of leaving the European community, now the European Union? The first country was Greenland, and I think it's not hard to see why Greenland thought that might be a good idea. It was right on the edge. But we were only just on the edge. So it's something very odd about us. When we joined the European community, of the large countries of Europe, we were the second most equal by income inequality. Only Sweden was more equal than us. This is in the 1970s. And this may be news for you. So part of the reason there was a campaign on the left to not join the European community, part of the reason why Michael Foot went to Enoch Powell's house and they chatted together because they had a common interest in trying to avoid us joining, was that on the left, it was thought that joining this club could lead us to become a less socialist country than the one we'd actually become. It wasn't joining the European community, though, that made us more unequal. One little set of stats for you. At the moment, we're the most economically unequal country in Europe, and we have been for at least a decade. The way I measure it is the way the OECD does, which is look at the income of the best off tenth of households. It's 28%. That's higher than any other country in Europe, including small countries in Eastern Europe. That 28%, half of it is taken by the best off 1%, about 14% of all income. And as far as I can see, that's the highest in Europe. But we weren't there back in the 1970s. We were the opposite. So if you want to understand what's happened to us, you have to understand why that great inequality grows. The differences you get across Europe at the moment, again according to the OECD, is that in Switzerland, the poorest tenth of people are paid about three times as much as the poorest tenth here. It's a very different place, and it's very strange to be talking about Switzerland as a wonderful example of equality. It isn't. It has a financial centre in Zurich and so on. It's not a radical Scandinavian country. But it shows how far we've moved. The best off 1% in Switzerland, which is largely financiers, take half what our best off 1% take. If you want to find the most equitable, it's in Denmark, where the best off tenth of households take five times more than the poorest tenth of households. Nowhere's utopia. Five-fold differences are enormous, but that's the best it gets in Denmark, which also happens to be the country in the world which records the highest levels of happiness. The World Happiness Survey is beginning to show nice correlations between inequality and happiness. Norway, it's 6-1 ratio. Germany, 6.5. France, 7.5. We have the highest 10-10 ratio, which is tenfold. It's nice and easy to remember. You have to go outside of Europe to find a higher one. The next highest of the richest 25 countries in the world is Israel, which is 15-1, and then USA, which is 19-1. So we're up there of the 25 richest countries in the world with at least 2 million people. We're in the top three. I thought it wasn't by chance that the first two world leaders that Trump's going to meet is either UK or Israel. You know, there's a kind of little coalition now of the willing to be very unequal places in the world. So why did it happen? Why did we see this increase in inequality from the late 70s, right through the 80s, and the big rush was in the 80s, carried on rising in the 90s, carried on rising a little bit slower under New Labour. Why did we see it, whereas other countries didn't? There's one very, very big difference between the UK and other European countries. And it's one I don't think we take enough notice of because of what, well, at least my generation, were taught when we were at school. And the big difference between us and other European countries is that we had an empire. And not any old empire. This was a very, very big empire. And it was also a very, very profitable empire. But we didn't tell ourselves that. We told ourselves it was a white man's burden to have to manage it. And it was a terrible thing. And all you got when you went away and spent 30 years as a colonial officer was to come back to the home counties and you got a cottage with roses around the door. And that was your kind of payoff for it. And we had an idea in our kind of collective heads that we become rich and powerful because we are very good at inventing things. So I was taught all these inventions that the British did before anybody else at school, and if I could memorise them all, I could get an A at O-level history. And then later on, when you grow up, you go over to Paris and you go to there, Museum of Industry, you discover that there's lots of French people inventing things at roughly the same time. All inventions were invented by two or three people at roughly the same time is what you eventually discover. But we were taught a history of superiority. We were early on. The evidence for that is that one in seven of all carbon atoms in the atmosphere, all the pollution in the world, is our coal. We've managed to fill up the atmosphere more than any other country because we started early. But we became so rich and powerful because we had an empire. And then as we began to lose the empire, as we lost India, we lost country after country from Africa, the benefits of that empire, the economic benefits, the captive markets, the control we had, began to reduce. But we didn't tell ourselves that that was the problem. We told ourselves what a wonderful job we were doing of giving people their freedom while we burnt all the notes in Kenya that actually showed what we'd been doing, because our civil servants were worried about being taken to court. And we told ourselves that we were the sick man of Europe in the 1970s because we had particularly vicious trade unions that went on strike all the time. That was the story we were brought up. But the country did become poorer. The best graph to see for the country becoming poorer is the ratio of the pound to the dollar. When my granddad was born, it was about $5 to the pound. When my mum was born, it's about four. When I was born, it's about three. When my oldest child was born, it's about two. I suspect it will be about one by the time we merge to become the 51st state in a couple of years' time. Anyway, it really is a plummet. The recent plummet is part of a long-term plummet. Another example, and again, this depends on age. The first time I went abroad was when I was 15, when I went to France. I could get 10 francs to the pound when I was 15. My relatives tell stories about how rich they felt in Europe after the war, when it was much higher. And of course that has come right down. When a country is slipping down economically, and this is a relatively rare thing to happen, the people it happened to before us were the Dutch, and that's a long time ago. When a country is slipping down relatively, it's most difficult for the people at the very top to take, because they've become used to wealth, power, influence. When we had to pay for the First World War, we imposed very high taxes on the population, mainly on the rich, and we took their houses from them. We did it in a very polite way, so they donated them to the National Trust. But people who had been in the top 1% of society could see their families becoming poorer. And that accelerated in the 1950s and 1960s. And it got really bad by the 1970s with inflation, because what inflation does is really eat away at the wealth of the wealthy. It doesn't hurt the poor particularly badly, but it hurts the wealthy. In the general election of October 1974, the southeast of the country swung dramatically to the Conservatives in the aftermath of the miners' strike of 1973. It wasn't enough to win an election, Labour still won the election, but it wasn't the most dramatic electoral geographical change of any election that I've seen, and the precursor to Margaret Thatcher's win in 1979. The point of pointing out that happened to you in 1974 is that it happened with a popular vote of people in the southeast of England. They'd had enough of miners being well paid. They'd had enough of watching their relative position drop. They'd had enough of finding it hard to fund private schools, which are all clustered almost all in the southeast of the country. They'd noticed things like the building in concrete in places like Oxford, which had run out of money because the alumni no longer had large amounts of money to give them, because we had become so equitable by the 1970s. And they really didn't like it. They wanted tall poppies to be allowed to rise, which was Margaret Thatcher's phrase, They wanted Britain to be great again. They didn't want this mollycoddling of the rest of the society. There was lots of use of the Union Jack at this time. You had little war in the Falklands just to, you know, become a bit more jingoistic. This behaviour of Britain, and then the big bang in the banks in 1986, and taking income tax levels right down, which is what the Conservative government did, and that Piketty has shown is the best correlation to rising inequality. It was all because of what had been lost. And when David Cameron talks about being the seventh in six generations of stockbrokers, generations 1, 2, 3, and 4 were amongst the richest 0.001% of people in the world. Whereas his dad was not doing that well compared to them. There's a sense of loss. That's not a sense that I feel, because I was brought up politically in a kind of different way to think about Britain and to think about the empire. But I do think you've got to understand that kind of feeling to work out why did we allow people who were a bit better off to become much, much better off and not worry about it, whereas they didn't in any other country of Europe to the same extent. I'll stop the landscape there and get on to the battle. Okay, I think that's the precursor for it. The battle. The battle was largely within the Conservative Party. It was within the Conservative Party under John Major, if you remember people stabbing in the back. And then UKIP kind of occasionally popped up as a very small party initially, and then a slightly bigger party, but still an odd party, that didn't do well until the BNP completely collapsed and then there was some space. But it was very different from the BNP, because UKIP essentially was the Conservative Party. If you looked at who ran the UKIP, it was people from the right wing of the Conservative Party. So this was an internal Conservative Party issue, this issue of sovereignty and breaking away from Europe and the annoyance. And it was largely seen as, I think, amusing to people in the middle of politics and people on the left. Not just amusing, but in some ways helpful. Wasn't it great that they were stabbing each other in the back and really worrying about this thing that they shouldn't have worried about? In hindsight, for my politics, that was quite a mistake to have made, but it's understandable. It's understandable because you've got a country which is so divided that people like me do not understand the sensibilities of people who this really, really matters to. And I might be wrong, you might be, don't worry, there's plenty of time for questions. You might be sitting there saying, I'm completely wrong about the importance of empire and so on, it's, you know, this is just what a democratic country should do. But there's still the question about why this democratic country? Why did Britain actually push it first? Now, if you look at the battle, the most interesting thing is who was in the battle and who was being paid to be in the battle. There are two people on the Leave side who I think were absolutely key. One was Dominic Cummings, who had been Michael Gove's SPAD in the Department of Education. And Dominic Cummings wrote the very long thesis about how some people were genetically superior to others, and the richest 1% are there because they are genetically superior. That's the most interesting thing about Dominic Cummings' thesis. I would claim that genetic research doesn't show this, but the key thing is that Dominic believed it, and believed it so much that he wrote this enormous thesis and put it on the web for everybody to see, and pushed himself forward enough to end up being paid by whoever funded the Leave campaign for him to work full time as, in effect, the deputy of it. Matthew Elliott, who was the CEO of the campaign, used to work for the Taxpayers Alliance. Now, how many of you know who the Taxpayers Alliance are? There's a few, so it's a minority. This isn't a conspiracy theory, this is just what happened. The Taxpayers Alliance is a group who presumably are funded by a few very wealthy people who may pay tax. unless unless they've worked out a way of avoiding it. It's a think tank that's a lobby for the very wealthy. It dislikes high tax rates. So why would somebody from an organisation like that end up leading the Leave campaign, and why would the Leave campaign be funded in many ways by people who also wanted to reduce their taxes? Because something really matters to them. They have in their heart the idea that we can be different, but also that it's fine for some people to have enormous amounts of wealth. There is a group of people, they're very quiet at the moment, but there are a group of people who advocate inequality, say it's good, they say it rewards talent, they say reducing inequality is inefficient. This may be the quietest that they've ever been. I mean, you've got Davos, the last 5 years, has had inequality in one of its top three things. Davos tends to produce 30 things that matter in the world. A couple of years ago, it was climate change, unemployment and inequality. This year, it was just inequality. Let's get. So you don't hear many people arguing for greater inequality publicly. But around the few people who do argue for it, there's a slightly smaller group who believe in it, but know now is not the time to shout out your arguments for it. So what you argue for instead is sovereignty, democratic accountability, ruling in your own country, the terrible effect of migrants, not respecting the fear of the working class who are losing their jobs to people who are coming in. You don't argue we want to pay really low taxes and be allowed to get away with it. But the battle on one side was fought by people who had that background. And on the other side, on the Remain side, the battle really wasn't fought at all, in hindsight, because it wasn't thought possible that the population would vote like this. And it was very marginal. It really was marginal. The money markets, which tend to get it right, and the spread betting, which tends to get it right, said it was going to be a Remain majority. The money markets absolutely jumped 15 minutes after the news of the MP being stabbed came out, before it was clear that she was actually going to die. The money markets in London thought that was it. They really misread how the population are likely to behave, or what news the population actually gets. And so on the 23rd of June, we get this result. And this result is unusual, but we have to look back. And I worry, you know, either I am too much of a conspiracy theorist, or why haven't people looked at who was pushing this and who was paying them and what they get out of it? And what is now being proposed, which is essentially turning us into a giant version of Jersey and Guernsey, and whose interest that is in, and whether the fact that the people who funded Leave and who might benefit from this, whether it might be connected? All. Okay, last part, just a couple of minutes on the battle. So I think we're now involved, for us at least, with this small little island which is of a declining importance, and almost certainly will carry on being of declining importance. We're now involved in something which is very interesting and much more dangerous than it's been for a long time. On the European mainland, inequalities, on average, are quite flat. In many countries, they are now falling. In some countries, they're rising. In countries that have the worst crisis, they can be rising if Syriza look after the rich in Greece, which they kind of quietly do. In other countries like Portugal, inequalities are falling because nobody looked after the aristocracy in Portugal, so Portugal's dropped out of the top four most unequal countries. But in the Netherlands, inequality is falling. In Denmark, they're generally falling. They're being kept low in the Scandinavian countries. Sometimes they shoot up, and then they shoot down again. But in general, inequalities are under some form of control on the mainland. In the UK, we're at the highest, but they could go higher, depending on what happens in the next 2 years. In the USA, you have this incredible situation of a man who believes it's good if somebody becomes a billionaire, who may have lost a quarter of his fortune over the summer when the property market in Manhattan and elsewhere where he has investments fell. That's according to Forbes magazine. You have an incredible situation of a man like that winning, telling people that he will make them more equal, at least the white ones more equal. And at the same time, and I sort of feel stupid, the nice thing about believing in equality being good is you don't have to worry about feeling stupid occasionally. I feel stupid that I didn't predict that you'd have a billionaire give an inaugural lecture where he talked about all the things that are really terrible in America, which largely are pretty terrible for any rich country in the world, and then have the left go, oh no, it's not that bad. I mean, that's absolutely bizarre what's happened in the last week. You're talking about the country with by far the highest rate of infant mortality in the rich world. Children's health is absolutely terrible, biggest obesity crisis, falling life expectancy for the middle classes. And you've got people on the left going, it's not that bad, because Donald Trump says it is bad. That's a very strange state we are in now. And of course, the biggest protest since the Vietnam War, which suggests that this is becoming an interesting period. Where are we going to go now? We've elected a whole set of MPs. Those MPs told us what they believed in before we elected them. They told us what they believed in during the Brexit campaign. Most of them told us they didn't believe in leaving. Now they're about, apparently for a majority of them, to vote against what they told us they believed in and to enact Article 50. I find that hard. Well, maybe they really do worry about their jobs and their income. And that's the only rational... No. If you really didn't believe in voting for Article 50, and you said you didn't believe, and you weren't lying, and I don't think they were lying, why would you vote for it? The only reason to vote for it is that £67,000 a year job with a little bit of money for your partner is the best you think you can get. And in a really unequal country like Britain, which looks economically to be in a bad state coming up, you can't all become director of the V&A. Is that where we are at? Is that why the MPs will toe the party line? I don't know. I'm just trying to open you up to ideas. What happens in the future? The one thing we should say is that the idea that we're going to get any stability over the next 5 years is probably the one thing we're not going to get. I think it's safe to say that stability is unlikely. So things will change. But you don't know what things will change. The one boringly, and again it's probably because of what I've looked at, I think could make a much bigger impact than anything else for Britain and behaviour, is the housing market. Now if you remember me telling you that Trump apparently lost a quarter of his fortune over the summer, which apparently is why he wouldn't release his tax returns, because it doesn't look very good, apart from whatever else might be in his tax returns. It wasn't just Manhattan that was going down over the summer. Prime London property, anything worth over 10 million, was falling over the summer. By October, Kensington and Chelsea was going down. By November, 3 London boroughs were going down. By December, 5 London boroughs were recording falling house prices. The number of transactions in the housing market has more than halved over the last 14, 16 months now. This is the precursor you get to a fall. Help to buy was scrapped, the main help to buy, not help to buy on new build, but the main one that where government lends you money to buy a house in Oxford. That ended at the end of December. Government ended it quietly, the new Chancellor ended it. Landlords have to meet much stricter rules to borrow from the first of this month than before, and so we've seen the biggest collapse in landlords borrowing since 2009, which is the financial crash. From April, landlords are going to be taxed more, and then more than next April, and then more than next April, and then more than next April by a Conservative government that put these tax changes in. So you don't hear much about it because nobody in Parliament's opposing it. And the Conservative Party are putting taxes up on landlords, I assume, because they've worked out that the rate at which landlords are buying property was likely to alienate the electorate very, very quickly. Because we've had a doubling of private tenants in 10 years. And it's very hard to persuade a population to vote for you if they're all being forced to pay rents to landlords. Pound collapses. So people who were buying flats in London from China stopped buying those flats. That might sound odd, because but they've suddenly become cheaper. So why don't they buy them? The Chinese are not that stupid. They've suddenly become cheaper, and they're getting cheaper still. You don't buy an investment that's going down in value. You wait till it stops dropping. And although it doesn't feel to us like things are falling at this calamitous rate, that's only because we're inside the country. If you're an overseas investor and the pound drops, you have to be a mug to buy something to shelter your money in a currency that's falling in value. My obsession with this is partly because we have the most overheated housing market in the world. London now costs more than Tokyo, the equivalent flat, the same distance away from the railway station. There are only so many billionaires in the world. They only want one penthouse suite in London each. Like, they alone are not enough to make it work. You can't have a country with this kind of precarity and uncertainty carry on with a housing market looking like it's so incredibly healthy. If the housing market falls, as the housing market falls in London, not yet in Oxford, our banks are reliant on the value of those houses. That's why they pass their stress tests, because their mortgages are backed up on the value of the property they've lent against. And so we have potential problems with our banks. Our bankers are not just moving jobs to Frankfurt and Paris because they want to look friendly. They are worried about being based in the UK. If you come back to Oxford, of all the regions of the European Union, all the NUTS 2 regions, Oxfordshire, Buckinghamshire and Berkshire receives the highest European research funding per head of anywhere in Europe. That's basically the university. Right. This is very, very bad news for this city. And then what's the second most important thing to the city economically? Produces 1% of all our manufacturing output of the entire UK. It's the car factory. Any of you heard BMW say anything since the 23rd of June? Right. Before the 23rd of June, they sent a letter to all their employers. Then it would be a bit tricky to run a car factory in Cowley if we were to leave. They didn't say that part of the reason it would be tricky is that half the workers are Eastern European who are on the line of that car factory, the last line about robots. But of course it's the cost of moving the goods back and forth, the engines and so on, that's the problem. There's a factory on the Austrian-Czech border being built now. You still maybe produce a few minis because there's an internal market in the UK that you could sell them to. But if you have a factory in Cowley with 1,200 robots, each the size to fit in a container that you can drive over to Austria, and people will come from the Czech Republic and work in your factory in Austria because it's only a few miles, what are you doing leaving the factory going in Oxford? That's just one I could give you, but I've run out of time. I can give you uncertainty after uncertainty after uncertainty. So here's the good news to end on. The good news to end on is that it's at times like this that things have tended to get better. After the Suez Crisis, we got the 1960s. We got the Lady Chatterley's Lover Trial. We got a judge saying, this is a book you'd want your wife and servants to read, and we laughed at the judge. We got a set of relatively young Labour MPs that nobody had heard of in the 1950s become a cabinet in 1964 that then made incredible changes to the country, which is partly why we were the most equitable place in Europe by the 1970s. We got comprehensive schools, we got investment in the health service that made it the best in the world on numerous reasons. But if anybody had told you that at the time of the Suez Crisis, that this country would become dramatically better off for most people in it, they wouldn't have believed you. You can do an even darker one by going forward before the Second World War, about how dire things were in 1936, but I don't want to go there. But if you're worried about war, the degree to which people have become averse to war in Europe and in rich countries is incredible. It's an incredible rise of aversion to war. So I tend to be optimistic about that. But it's scary. It is scary. And things don't always get better. If we do go down the tax haven route, that is the hard Brexit, lowest corporation taxes in the world, flat tax, it will benefit about half of the 1%, maybe less. It won't benefit the majority of graduates from the University of Oxford, benefit the majority of postgraduates from the University of Oxford. They tend to be a bit better on than the undergraduates. It's certainly not going to benefit 99% of people. Half young women in Britain now go to university. How are you going to sell this to a population that this really is in their interest? I don't think that's going to work. But I think it's a battle now for becoming even more unequal to the United States, which is what the tax haven island would be, or deciding that enough is enough and a painful ratcheting down of inequality and actually drawing in our consumption. And it won't feel great at the beginning, but we'll head towards becoming a more normal European country, even if we're not in Europe. That's where I think the battle is. It's between those two scenarios. It's not being presented like that at all. But that's my feeling as to where we are. Thank you for tolerating me emptying my brain out to you. It's an honest idea of where we are. And please ask me some questions, and we'll definitely finish in 20 minutes at 1:30 because we have to drink that wine. And that's your reward. Okay, who's got a question? The back? I'm most interested in your questions because I've heard myself far too many times before.
Thanks very much for your talk. I was interested in your interpretation of the sort of Tory or UKIP right and their motivations for supporting Brexit. And a lot of your interpretation was the idea that they had their own financial interests which rode on supporting Brexit, and this is the primary, if I understood you correctly, that you were suggesting that that's the primary motivation for supporting Brexit. It's in the name of sovereignty, you're supporting your own financial...
Well, they're friends. They've all made massive sacrifices, which you've got to get in the head. So... all of them have chosen not to do jobs which would have made them far more money than being foreign minister or prime minister. So they, from their point of view, they're people who've sacrificed but for the good of the country, but the people around them who have the jobs that they could have done will benefit. Yeah. Right. And the people who fund the party, if you look at the black and white board that funds the Conservative Party.
Sure. So it's just on the point of, for instance, saying that an MP is, going in and supporting, like an MP who said they wouldn't support Brexit and then is voting in favour of Article 50, might not necessarily be making a U-turn. They may believe in the rise of a democratic decision and support democracy as a prior concern over their own position on Brexit itself. But then on top of that, the idea that an MP would just be worried about merely their job security or their projecting their salary. And as you mentioned, many MPs take a pay cut when they go into Parliament. And in addition, it's also what's perhaps more, much more meaningfully affected to an MP in that situation is the extent to which they can support other causes within Parliament that they might find much more significant, or in which they could make a much bigger difference. So I just felt that there was a little bit of uncharity that was...
Yeah, I'm only being uncharitable. We take Labour MPs. On average, Labour MPs can't get a better paid job than this. They don't tend to. The democracy thing is it's a referendum. It's not binding. It's a referendum which actually some of them did vote for, but not all of them. They want to keep that quiet, by the way. MPs are a bit worried about the fact that they voted for it. But it's advisory. And what's the point of having them? So you could do one with a death penalty. And then should they go along with that? We only had one because we got that result in May 2015 that wasn't expected. Cameron was hoping for a coalition, in which case he wouldn't have had to have done this. He was planning for a coalition, which is partly why they helped Clegg still win this seat in Sheffield. So it happened very, very quickly. It was short-sighted. Osborne got one thing right. He said, don't do it, from that point of view. But why would Labour MPs who don't believe in this follow the whip that Jeremy Corbyn's given them, given that Jeremy Corbyn has defined the whip more than any other MP? And if you believe that you're in Parliament to do greater good, but the longer you're in Parliament, the more you realise you can't do the things you imagined you could do. But also, if you're not there, somebody else will be the MP, and they could do just as good a job as you, if not better. But I'm just going to find it odd if there's a very large majority of MPs actually voting for Article 50. And it's got to go through the Lords as well. That's going to be interesting. The speed at which they're doing it. I haven't caught up the news in the last hour.
Is that a mistake?
Okay, they really are.
That's what it's saying, yeah.
Desperately trying to stop people thinking. I mean, that's the only reason you do it that fast is you would be worried about if you gave them the weekend. Right? If you gave them the weekend to go back and talk to their friends, they might behave in a different way. So it looks like an attempt to jump people into it.
But what about the argument that if their constituents were, you know, voted for Brexit, then they're, you know, kind of obliged to follow that trend and not go against where the constituents have voted?
For? I wouldn't do referendums. That's my... Yeah. And if I was an MP, I wouldn't vote for them. I'd say, you vote for me, I'm never going to support a referendum. You don't have to vote for me. I'm not going to support one and I won't follow one. But it's easy in hindsight. You know, we've had very few. Is it four referendums? Tiny number. This was the only one that didn't go the way it was supposed to go by the entire establishment.
That's all right. I really enjoyed that. I wondered if I could ask about the thing you said at the start about his empire.
Yeah.
And so you made a point, you know, you said, you know, we had an empire and that forms some sort of long-term context for inequality in this country. And so increasingly historians understand empire, home of empire, as, you know, much more intertwined than maybe they used to, you know, in the past. And underline as an example the sort of, the fact that the agro-industrial landscapes of the West Indies are actually rather like the agro-industrial landscapes of the North of England or of Wales. And that in many ways the stories that we can tell about empire and home, not from the elite, perspective, and we heard a lot of elite, perspective in your later bit, but actually from the perspective of the people, working in these industries as they were, and then what happens when those industries end. In a lot of ways, I wonder whether there are sort of overlapping histories there, and whether we, the way in which we think about the post-colonial and the post-industrial as if they're separate things, is there a sense in which a sort of end of empire and then the end of industry in the UK were a part of a single, longer term sort of process that allows us to, to think about inequality in this country as being exactly the same as with the Caribbean, about a relationship with the metropolis.
Okay, so that, I should just say, one thing on the referendum, there's always a possibility that we never talk about, that this might be good for the rest of Europe, because we had a very unfair deal, we weren't paying our fair share. So it's not impossible that us leaving allows the rest of Europe to do things that we were stopping them from doing. And if you're a real optimist on that, you can say actually it's a price worth paying if we leave. No, we'll be okay eventually. The connections. I think there's loads to be done on this. If you go to New Zealand and you want to buy any bedding, it's called Manchester on the shelves. The word for bedding and cotton, it's just called Manchester. And still, that's what it is. And of course, they had a terrible problem with what they were going to do with their sheep when we suddenly joined, and they had to find another market for their sheep. They learned from that. They were very quick today. They went straight to China today, New Zealand, Australia, and went, please can you just take the US's place? Which I think is partly remembering what it felt like when Britain dumped them. And the other connection, if you go to the West Indies, which I've never been to, I must say, your geography always uses an excuse, but even after independence, we carried on getting labour at the time when we wanted it. So we brought over young men and women to do jobs that needed to be done in London. And they left their children behind. I only discovered this recently. Very large numbers of children were left behind in Jamaica to be looked after by elderly grandparents. It's part of the reason why the gang culture got really bad, because there weren't any parents, because they were fixing buses in London. But as that relationship began to fall and we couldn't use people in quite that way as easily, as people worked out that other places to go to in the world than the home country, and the home country wasn't as great as your textbooks have told you, it decreased. It's George Orwell said it in 1946, when Labour was building the welfare state. He said you could only do this because you've got an empire and you don't realise that it's possible to do this because you've still got the wealth of an empire that lets you do it. And I think he was quite a low voice back then.
I was very interested in your concentrating really on the hardships of the wealthy, in as much as they are feeling the pressure now, which very much inverts my natural assumptions, which have always tended to be that when the going gets tough, it's the poor who get the worst. Now, I suppose to some extent this is about relative and absolute advantage.
Yeah.
Because you're at the bottom, you've got hardly anywhere to go. And so they feel intense pain, even though they may be perhaps not losing as much proportionally, if I understood you correctly. But I wondered how far one needs also, in the context of the referendum, to think about the hardships of the working class districts that voted to leave. It's quite interesting that London, of course, strongly voted to remain. Your 1974 Tory heartland. Voted to remain, and where we had a lot of the strength of the Leave vote seemed to be in the people who were feeling the pain of unemployment or competition for their jobs.
It looked like that, but it's very similar reporting with the Trump reporting. So you have these high votes in a couple of East Coast constituencies like Great Yarmouth. Then Middlesbrough looks a bit higher, but 60% of Leave votes are in the south, and the swathe of what got you Leave was 56% of people in Tewkesbury voting Leave. I did a little program in Tewkesbury and went there for a day, not really long enough to try and work out why 56% of people voted Leave. Certainly not immigration, very hard to find much immigration to Tewkesbury. But Tewkesbury just looked a bit run down. And when you talk to people in Tewkesbury, they say that their kids can't get a house, they can't start a family. The high street in Tewkesbury, which is a kind of supposed to be a picture postcard town, has a tattoo parlour and a town shop on it. You know, the country's fallen a long way from when it was relatively at the top of the world. So I think that the middle class, relatively well off in the kind of bottom of the top third, whose children, if they've got more than one child or grandchild, can't make a start in life nowadays. That was the bulk of the votes that mattered. In a similar way with Trump, the average Trump voter was over averagely better off, but in a district that was going down socially. So it was white men with better than average salaries seeing everything falling around them. People who are poorer didn't vote for Trump. In Oxford, it's the poorest quarter who voted Leave. But Oxford's very weird, as we've discovered. And that's part of what's gone on over 30 years. Is as this country has become more and more divided, London's become a place where you can only be there if you're winning. You have to leave after they sack you from the job. You have to leave within 4 weeks because you can't pay the rent. And so London's always full of winners because the losers are pushed out. Oxford's increasingly like London. It's full of winners. The men here have no chance of getting housed. If you're female and get pregnant, then they will house you, but they may well house you in Birmingham or Coventry because they've run out of places to house you in Oxford. So Oxford our unemployment rate is about 0.9% because you can't afford to be here and be unemployed. And that creates the weirdness of these places that are very strong remain. The average life in Britain for the average person with the average wealth and the average little three-bed semi doesn't allow the generation beneath you to do well. So I think the elderly voted Brexit because they were thinking about the future for their grandchildren. I don't think it was selfish. It's actually a very dangerous thing to do for the elderly. Because if it makes it harder to actually afford a health service, you're not going to get 350 million more a year. If you get many elderly coming back from Spain to use our health service, you're actually reducing your chances of survival. And at the same time as we have the Brexit vote, we also have people's health getting worse. On the day of the vote, on the 23rd of June, government released the annual mortality figures, which showed that more than 40,000 extra elderly people had died that year. In 2015, it was never reported because there was too much news. So you have an elderly population who on average are not doing well, and it's not just the poor. The irony of this, sorry to come back, one more question. The biggest rise in mortality in Britain has been people around about age 80-85. To get to 80-85, you tend to have had to be middle class in the past, so it's better off people. But once the meals and wheels go, which you need, and they've largely gone, once the social worker doesn't visit once a week, once they're queuing trolleys all the way back to the entrance of the John Radcliffe with people of that age, the middle class who voted Margaret Thatcher in 1979 and 1983 are now dying prematurely in an underfunded NHS and can't see their children starting families or being safe. And watching schools being funded less, and everybody's got a degree, so how are their kids going to be okay? I don't think we should press on. It's entirely possible to sort this out. You just look at what a normal European country does and how you look after each other. The problem of having gone for dog-eat-dog competition is that basically this is what you get, and we're kind of learning it.
Just I declare a small interest before I ask a question. I work in property in Oxford, so yeah. I have a slight insight into that. I was interested in your landscape, and there is another difference in Europe that that in Germany 64% live in rented accommodation, France 47%, in Oxford 50% live in rented accommodation. And is there a correlation between equality and rented accommodation? For example, in the 70s, when we had a high level of people living in local authority owned rented accommodation, it was a very equitable time. Women got the vote when the most people lived in rented accommodation in the UK. I think that if debt of the modern chains of slavery, and the mortgage is the most powerful debt mechanism in the world, should we be encouraging the private rented sector rather than what the Tories are doing now, which is knocking it?
Well, I would just... You can look at the Netherlands and Germany and look at Vienna. Vienna's my favourite for these mental of how to do it. The problem with a mortgage now is it's sold to you as, you know, you and you will get together and for 25 years you'll pay this thing off. Nobody lasts more than seven. You know, so the mortgage is dangerous. The problem is you just want to give people the same kind of tenure that they've got in Germany. People can put their own kitchen in, but you want to be in a situation where, you know, if you want to get your tenants out, you have to bribe them out. If they're well behaved, they can stay for as long as possible. And we refuse to look in Europe and see that this is possible. I should be renting in this city. I should be renting, but I can't rent because I've got children and I've moved them from one school to another, and the idea of moving them again and again, if a landlord wants to move me out, and you just want decent rental, but we don't look there at it to work out how to get there.
We don't build enough houses because that would undermine the value of the existing stock and destroy the economy.
Well, more of our wealth is in housing than any other country. We've just pushed ourselves into that. But we don't...
What's the solution, then?
The solution's probably crisis. Yeah, the fastest way out is not necessarily what you want, what you plan. In 1989, when they had the crash in Tokyo, house prices halved by about 1991. And it kind of had to happen. It's just not... the short-term effects of it. And again, it's like the person who really loses out is the person in the top 10th of society or top 5%, age 42, who's finally managed to buy that £600,000 flat in London, just as it loses the first £100,000 of its value. And there's going to be, and the problem is because we've become a society that sort of says you take your own risk, you win money, they're going to get an enormous lack of sympathy for doing that. But you partly have to recognise that it isn't good to want to change it, otherwise we'll sit back and enjoy it and think we'll all be okay. There's other things coming. The student debt, which they now get a letter every year. 8 years worth of students are going to get that letter by 2020. There's all kinds of things we've stacked up that are not sustainable. And that to me is good news. If this was sustainable, I'd be a bit annoyed, because I don't think it's a good way of operating things. And I also don't think that the people in the top 5 or even 1% of society are particularly happy about it. Some of them think that making Britain great again. George Osborne promised that by 2030 we'd be the richest country in the world, only a year and a half ago. Yeah, so there's a small group who have this particular fantasy. But I think the bulk realise that game is over. You want to become a pleasant and nice place and use your advantages of the English language, you know, being in the right time zone and so on, but not necessarily in the banks, and have a very pleasant life. But you can't do that when you've got a small group going, we want to be the richest in the world. At some point, the majority of people who don't think they're going to be in that category of winning millions and billions, they're going to have to say that they've had enough of it. And you can sense real unease at the moment. You can't see it moving through to things other than large marches. It could result in very, very different voting patterns. That's one thing we are getting. So
So there are two constituencies in Oxfordshire that will probably go Liberal. Or at least the one we're probably in now, it's a few hundred metres that way. No. The Liberals are going to win Oxford West and Abingdon. Because the Progressive Alliance, it's an obvious seat. The harder one is West Oxfordshire. And that, where they came second in a by-election. I'm not a Liberal, but that kind of behaviour change of people swinging their votes far more than they've ever done before, young people turning out to vote again, that stopped in the early 1990s. If that starts to happen, then lots and lots of things are possible. Using up wine time. So thank you very much, and please come and get a glass. Thank you.